I can think of several scenarios that are more believable than Dallas doing this. It strikes me as ludicrous.
Iditarod racers react to the dog doping scandal. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the complexities of attempting oil tax reform.
Every time we moved a piece of law, another piece of law popped up in another section. Oops, these are interrelated. What do we do with this other piece?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Education scholarships and grants for ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, are available. To learn where the possibilities this education can take you, visit beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. Energy lives here.
The mushing world has been rocked by an unfolding scandal over doping in the Iditarod. It started 2 weeks ago when the race's governing body announced it was changing rules for drug tests after a banned substance was found in four dogs from a top team. Speculation ignited, and yesterday, the Iditarod Trail Committee announced it was dogs in the team of four-time champion Dallas Seavey. But Seavey insists he didn't do it, which, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, is fueling a mystery right beside the ballooning controversy.
As the dust settles on news that Seavey's dogs tested positive for the synthetic opioid tramadol, there are a few major questions still looming. The biggest is, did Seavey give his dogs drugs to do better in mushing's most high-profile and lucrative race?
I am in a unique position in that I am probably the only person on the planet that can say 100% definitively that I did not give this to my dogs.
In an interview on his way to the airport for a pre-scheduled trip out of Alaska, Seavey reiterated the same points he insisted on in a long video posted just as his name was coming out in the press. He says it makes no sense that someone familiar with the race's drug testing program would give high levels of a banned substance to dogs in the hours close to arriving in Nome. But he doesn't dispute the positive drug tests, which has left him and everyone else involved searching for an explanation of who gave tramadol to his dogs.
I can't honestly say. I don't know. I want to find out. And I think this is the type of stuff that the Iditarod should be looking into.
Seavey says when he was told of the positive drug test in April, he worked with race officials to figure out where the painkillers could have come from. His understanding was that, based on the facts of the case, he was presumed not guilty. And the Iditarod Trail Committee's board of directors didn't sanction him by banning him from races or disqualifying his second-place finish in March. But here's where things get really complicated. The Iditarod board voted to change their drug testing rules in a way that places the burden of proof on the musher if there's a positive drug test. When they announced that change in October, they referenced a top-place musher's failed test without naming him or her. Rumors of who it could be exploded, as did a demand from mushers for the offender to be identified. Seavey says in that vacuum of information, there were enough clues released, along with leaks to members of the media, that it was only a matter of time until people accused him of doping his dogs.
I would have been shut up. It takes away my credibility.
And this brings up the case's other significant question. Was this incident mishandled? Seavey says yes. He feels mistreated by the Iditarod's board of directors, which he says made it sound like he was guilty when there was no evidence that he gave his dogs drugs. Seavey has used his star power in the past to criticize board decisions, like the allowance of two-way communication devices, but he says because of the so-called gag rule, which limits mushers' ability to publicly criticize the race or its sponsors, he felt he couldn't speak openly about the flaws he saw in the investigation and its handling, which is why he withdrew from next year's race.
I will not subjugate myself to this board. The only authority they have over me is when I choose to compete in this race. The feeling from the board is that they can do whatever they want. The mushers will kick and scream, but come March, we will be at the start. So I'm saying no, I will not be at the start.
If you take all of the elements that we have in front of us, somehow those dogs were provided with tramadol.
Chas St. George is ITC's chief operations officer. He says that since the race started testing dogs for banned drugs in 1994, this is the first time there's been a positive test like this, and as such, a precedent-setting response. And St. Cloud points out, discord between ITC's board and mushers is as old as the race itself. What's concerning, he says, is that there is no prevailing explanation of how a top musher's animals were given a powerful controlled substance used on pets to treat chronic pain from diseases like cancer.
That unanswered question is disturbing.
Right now, CV and others are floating around the word sabotage, perhaps from another musher, a disgruntled handler, a rival fan, or an anti-mushing animal rights group. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, has been using the unfolding incident as an opportunity to further condemn the race, though a spokesperson says they had no personnel in Alaska during last year's Iditarod. If these theories seem far-fetched, for many of those who know mushing best, they are more plausible than the idea that CV intentionally doped his dog. On Facebook, a number of mushers have come out saying they believe CV's side of the story. One of them is four-time champion Jeff King, who's competed neck and neck with the younger CV for years.
And I would love to find out who did this. And I can think of several scenarios that are more believable than Dallas doing this. It strikes me as ludicrous.
King says the sport is getting a black eye from what's happening, but he isn't pointing at any particular person or group as deserving of blame. He wishes the information had come to light sooner. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The legislature is looking to revise last year's law that overhauled the criminal justice system, but lawmakers don't appear likely to repeal it. The House Judiciary heard a variety of proposed changes to Senate Bill 54. The bill would scale back some of the reductions in criminal sentencing enacted last year. Anchorage Republican Representative Charisse Millett is seeking to amend the bill. She expects that some representatives will introduce a repeal of last year's Senate Bill 91.
But reading the tea leaves, I see that we probably don't have enough votes to do a full repeal. So I'm going to work on things that I see in the bill that are great changes that could significantly change what SB 91 has done to my community.
Millett says the largest change she's seeking is to nix the reductions in criminal sentences made last year. The House Judiciary Committee began considering amendments today. It is scheduled to take public testimony on the bill tonight. While the legislature is in session in Juneau to talk about taxes and crime, some lawmakers also used the opportunity to call together a new oil and tax gas tax working group. The legislative working group was formed when the lawmakers passed the latest oil tax reform earlier in 2017. Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel is a co-chair of the working group. She says the process of passing the last oil tax bill was illuminating. She says when lawmakers tried to remove cash credits from the tangle of oil tax credit law, things got complicated.
Every time we moved a piece of law, another piece of law popped up in another section. Oops, these are interrelated. What do we do with this other piece? And so we began to fully acknowledge and appreciate the complexity of our tax structure.
Geisel says she isn't sure if oil and gas taxes are going to come up again during the next regular session that starts in January. She says the group is meeting to prepare just in case tax reform ends up in front of the legislature. The working group includes Democrats and Republicans from both the state House and Senate. Members said on today they are interested in studying ways to give incentives to oil companies for operating in Alaska, like building roads and infrastructure. They'll continue to meet to evaluate Alaska's current system and hear from analysts. During the next session, they'll present a set of recommendations to the legislature. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska tribes join forces to fight mines.
We want the federal government to uphold its fiduciary trust responsibility and its government-to-government relationship with its tribe.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The National Congress of American Indians, known as NCAI, is calling for the reinstatement of the Northern Bering Sea Climate Resilience Area. The tribal advocacy group held its annual conference the same week as the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. NCAI passed a resolution urging the federal government to restore the federal designation as originally issued and to incorporate traditional knowledge into all federal decision-making that would affect the Northern Bering Sea region. The resolution mirrors similar resolutions passed by the Association of Village Council Presidents and the Koerik Native Regional Nonprofit Corporation. Both groups, along with the Bering Sea Elders Group, had advocated for the designation. The resilience area was created in December 2016 in an executive order signed by President Obama. The order required the federal government to consult with Alaska tribes on decisions affecting the Northern Bering Sea and to gather traditional knowledge to inform decisions regarding the region. In April of this year, President Trump extinguished that order, removing the tribal consultation requirement and potentially opening Arctic waters to offshore oil and gas leasing. Tribal groups from opposite ends of the state have formed an alliance to fight mines that they say threaten traditional fisheries. Organizations representing about 30 Southeast Alaska and Bristol Bay tribes signed a memorandum of agreement last week during the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage. The United Tribes of Bristol Bay opposes Southwest Alaska's Pebble Mine Project. The Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission is critical of mines and exploration projects in British Columbia watersheds that drain into state waters. Frederick Olson Jr. chairs the Southeast Coalition.
To combine with several tribes from the other part of the state should send a powerful message to everyone, and especially the federal government, that we want the federal government to uphold its fiduciary trust responsibility and its government-to-government relationship with its federally recognized tribes.
Olson says the organizations agreed to back each other's efforts to protect their region's fisheries. United Tribes of Bristol Bay President Robert Hyeno says what he calls mega mines are threatening indigenous people. He says the unification effort is, quote, a powerful move to defeat these toxic projects. Olson says the two regional efforts have similar goals, but some differences.
With our issue, the mines are in a different country, so maybe our fight's a little more uphill. It's hard to say which one's harder, of course. You know, the grass is always browner on the other side of the fence in this issue.
He says the coalition hopes to expand the alliance to tribal groups in other parts of the state. Hundreds of Juneau homeowners will stay warm this winter using an improved technology. Heat pumps are nothing new, but upgrades over the past 30 years have made the systems a lot more reliable. Now, local installers are racing to keep up with growing demand. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Inside Tracy Heaton's home, next to a pair of snowshoes hanging on the wall, is a white rectangular box.
At first, I really didn't like it, but now it just blends in with the house.
I can set the temperature to go higher or lower.
Heaton had this wall-mounted air source heat pump installed about a year ago. Before, she used to keep her home warm with a combination of electric baseboard heating and a wood pellet and oil stove. But these days, the $10,000 heat pumps are mostly doing the job, though she says there are times when the backups come in handy. To pay for the heat pumps, Heaton tapped into a state program that awarded homeowners money for efficiency upgrades. That program was cut in 2016 because of Alaska's budget deficit. And Heaton says that's too bad, because installing them has meant big savings.
They have cut our heat bill down dramatically.
Last winter, Heaton's monthly power bill fell by half. The savings can be very different from home to home. Still, there's growing demand for heat pumps in Juneau. And for companies that do the installations, this is a busy time of year.
Northern Refrigeration, this is Amy.
Northern Refrigeration opened in 2013. And since then, owner John Howard says his business has installed around 300 heat pumps. He says the fervor spread quickly. By his second year,
it was crazy. I was doing probably three to four walkthroughs, you know, sizing up heat pump systems for people every week.
The capital city, like the rest of the region, doesn't have a natural gas distributor, so it's common to burn heating fuel or rely on standard electric heating to stay warm. Heat pumps first came on the market in the 1970s and 80s as another option for places with temperate climate. And there are a lot of different types, everything from air source to the more expensive ground source or geothermal. But Howard says the older generation of heat pumps gave the technology a bad rap.
They're extremely noisy, they're big, and it costs a lot of money to operate.
Howard says today, the units run a lot more efficiently. And if you've eaten ice cream, you probably already know how the science works. He explains it to his clients like this. You bring a gallon of ice cream home. Maybe it sat in your car too long and gotten melty and soft.
Well, you put it in the freezer and you pull it out the next day and it's, you know, it's hard again.
He says your freezer is actually pulling the heat out of the ice cream, making it cold. And similarly, heat pumps can pull warmth from the ground or air. That warm air might not be detectable to the human touch, but it's there. But the heat pumps themselves, those run off of electricity. As more people get them, Juneau's local utility is monitoring the electric demand. The utility says it hasn't noticed a large impact yet, since the past few winters have been normal to mild. But it is keeping tabs, as fewer people fire up their stoves. Tracy Heaton, from before, says overall, she's happy with the technology.
But I thought I'd take out the baseboard heaters, and we're going to keep them in just because we did have to use them a couple times.
Even so, Heaton says using heat pumps saved her about $250 a month. And with the extra money, she says she was finally able to beat the chill. She took her family on a winter trip to Mexico. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
A commercial rocket is expected to launch in January or February 2018 at a state-owned aerospace company's facility on Kodiak Island. The Kodiak Daily Mirror reports Alaska Aerospace Corporation has secured 3 launch contracts and has a 4th in the works. Ad Astra, a Texas-based aerospace company specializing in advanced plasma rocket propulsion technology, is scheduled for the first launch. Vector Space Systems is expected to launch from the facility in late 2018. Company CEO Craig Campbell says he hopes the U.S.-based aerospace company Rocket Lab will be ready to launch in August in Alaska in 2019.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The city and borough of Juneau is pushing forward with plans for an emergency warming shelter that would open its doors to the homeless when temperatures drop below freezing. A key assembly committee met Monday and agreed in principle to commit $75,000 for the downtown warming center it hopes to have ready by mid-November. City Manager Rory Watt says his office is in talks with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority to rent the former state public safety building on Whittier Avenue. The rent would be at market rate, around $8,000 for the winter, although he told assembly members that the city could apply to the trust's board for a discount.
We recognize that the Mental Health Trust is a willing building owner that would be easy to work with on this topic that I don't think would be true of all private building owners.
The city had looked at using its downtown transit center, which is already a common place for homeless people to congregate, but Watt told the assembly he could see problems with that idea.
The transit center, you know, it has a day function, and part of the thinking is that if it's a night warming shelter, and then magically at 7 in the morning it stops being a warming shelter and tries to become a transit center, that's not really going to be successful. It's going to be a day-round shelter.
The warming shelter would be designated to accommodate about 25 people. The city estimates it would be open as needed between mid-November and mid-April. The Juneau Commission on Housing and Homelessness brought the idea of a warming center to the Assembly's Task Force on Homelessness, which endorsed the plan. The Juneau Assembly must formally authorize the warming shelter next month for it to open by November 15th. Based on the latest test scores, Sitka's school district is performing above the state average, but the numbers are not necessarily something to brag about. Instead, Sitka's educators hoped the new test results help them focus their efforts on underperforming populations in the schools. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Depending on the subject area, Sitka's rates of proficiency are pretty low, according to Assistant Superintendent Sarah Ferency, running from around 33 to over 60%. In general, Sitka students are performing at far higher levels in science than they are in math. In English language arts, just over half, about 55%, are proficient. Ferency told the Sitka School Board during a work session earlier this month that none of this was unexpected.
In a lot of ways, this new set of standards is more rigorous than the old standards, and so it's not super surprising that our students may not be proficient yet because they haven't had a lifetime of instruction in these new, more rigorous standards.
It has been a rocky road for testing in Alaska since the adoption of new standards in 2012, many of which were aligned with a national effort to improve curriculum called Common Core. Sitka students fared pretty well under the old testing regime called the Standards-Based Assessment, or SBA. Following the adoption of the new standards came the new test, the Alaska Measures of Progress, or AMP, which was eventually canceled after an internet connection was severed during the middle of testing in the spring of 2016, causing catastrophic delays. The new test is called PEAKS, or the Performance Evaluation for Alaska's Schools. Both Sitka's AMP results and now its PEAKS results are far lower than the SBA. Nevertheless, Ferency said that Sitka's kids are not going downhill.
Let's be realistic. Kids, on average, don't change a lot year to year. The kids, you know, learning stayed roughly the same, but the way the test measured it changed.
School board member Dionne Brady Howard argued that education advocates should carry a clear message to the Alaska legislature next January.
That our test data is changing, not because they're not getting enough for their money spent, but because nobody's been able to land on a consistent set of standards or testing or anything that have spanned these students' educational career to be able to consistently figure out where they are.
But even though the standardized test results don't fully address the quality of education in the district, Ferency said they had value, primarily in identifying troubled population groups in schools. According to Ferency, the biggest at-risk group in Sitka schools is not who you might think it is.
About 35 to 40% of Sitka students qualify for free and reduced lunch, and that number's been going up in recent years. I think it's of note that economically disadvantaged students are actually our largest subgroup of all of the subgroups that we look at.
The other large subgroup performing below its peers has been of concern for years, Alaska Natives. Ferency explained that the best way to improve overall district performance was to put energy into economically disadvantaged students and into Alaska Natives.
These two are the areas that we want to focus on if we want to, I don't want to call it low-hanging fruit because it's not easy, but is the areas where we'll have the most impact because it's the highest number of students who are affected and where the achievement gaps are largest.
PEAKS, Ferency pointed out, is designed to test only whether students meet or exceed a certain standard. It doesn't point out shortcomings in knowledge or in content. For that, it turns out, you need more than data. You need teachers. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The first measurable snow of the season fell in Anchorage on Saturday. The city got 0.3 inches. The snow came 6 days later than normal, according to Brian Bretschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment. Bretschneider told editor Annie Feit that the first measurable snow is different than the first trace of snow.
A trace means less than 0.1 inches. So that could be one snow flurry, or it could be a small dusting that's less than 0.1 inches. Normally, the first trace of snow would be observed on October 5th. And so this year, we didn't even have a single snow flurry until we got our measurable snow on the 21st. So that was our trace amount was actually 16 days late versus 6 days late for our measurable snow.
And what about the rest of the state?
This season, the rest of the state's pretty much on track. Some places are a little early. Some places are a little late. The only place that's kind of pretty late right now is Bethel. They should have had their first measurable snow on October 11th. And so they're pushing 10 plus 2 weeks late on their first measurable snow.
Has climate change impacted when the first snow occurs in Alaska?
That's a great question. The first snow is this great marker for the season. You know, it's winter. And because we are warming, that's uncontrovertible. We are warming. Alaska's warming faster than most of the rest of the world. That means we're having shorter winters. That being said, the date of the first snowfall is really a very poor marker for climate change because you can have just a small confluence of local events dump a quick, 10th or 2/10 of an inch of snow, and then you've marked it in the books as your first snow date. So generally around the state, we haven't shifted that date very much over time. So for example, Fairbanks, their first measurable snow date is about 3 days earlier now than it used to be. Other places like Bethel, it's about 3 days later. And so most places are within about a week or so of the date now versus the date, say, more than 40 years ago.
Does the first snow of the season mean anything for how much snow we're actually going to get during the winter?
Well, everyone likes to say, we had an early snow. That means it's going to be a big snow winter. Or, man, the first snow was really late. We haven't had much snow in October. And that means it's going to be a really low snow winter. The thing is, in Alaska, it makes really no difference at all. If you plot out all the dots of when the first snow fell versus the seasonal total, you get just complete random patterns. It means absolutely nothing.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zechariah Hughes and Annie Feit in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman, Elizabeth Jenkins, Ed Schoenfeld, Jacob Resnick, and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play.
The Northwest Arctic Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Kotzebue, October 25th and 26th, at the Northwest Arctic Borough Assembly Room from 9 to 5. To discuss proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and other issues related to subsistence, the public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.